You're listening to the Myth Korean Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Mike Hernandez, and Chris Winkle.
There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks, she had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do. So she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode is brought to you by our patrons, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek, and Ari Ashkenazi.
This is the Myth Korean Podcast. I'm Chris, and with me is...
Oren.
And we have a special guest, Wesley, who actually does a lot more Myth Koreans than you probably know, because he's one of our behind-the-scenes copy editors.
Hello.
Always finding mistakes with my work. So many mistakes.
I'm just guiding you along the correct path, Oren. Come on.
Why is the correct path so full of pain and torment? I don't understand.
The red ink is strong with this one.
Yes. You will be forged in the fires of my red ink.
This is accurate. Accurate depiction.
Actually, yes. The forging is a great metaphor for that. today we're going to talk about books we have read that have had strong foreshadowing, not bad foreshadowing, which I actually found is much easier, but actually good foreshadowing, present foreshadowing.
That's appropriate because we didn't foreshadow Wes being here at all. It was just like, hey, he's here now, whatever.
Yes, well, you know, setting examples isn't always our forte. One thing I like to mention when I talk about foreshadowing is the different types of foreshadowing, because I find that when people talk about foreshadowing outside of speculative fiction, they often are talking about a different type than one that is we focus on the most in speculative fiction. So it generally, and you guys can tell me if you know of any other reasons for it, but in my experience, it generally has two purposes. One is to raise the tension and make things more exciting, and the other is for believability. It's to set something up so that when it shows up, it doesn't feel weird, which is much more important in speculative fiction than it is in other works, because we have our world could include anything, absolutely anything. So we have to be carefully introduce things so that the reader knows that they're included in the world. Whereas, and speculative fiction also has tension-raising foreshadowing, but I find that when people talk about foreshadowing in mainstream writing, they're focusing a lot more on foreshadowing to raise tension.
Yeah, I think I would generally agree with that. I think the one thing that I would add, that even though like speculative fiction definitely incorporates like so much extra world building and stuff, I think that certain like canon texts, I recently read Hyperion, and that draws on so many like real actual world events that I think allusions play quite a bit of big of a role in terms of foreshadowing, even in speculative fiction, because it's still tapping into that kind of general knowledge that many of us are exposed to growing up. And I have an example of that we can talk about later.
Oh, yeah. I'd love to hear it.
I was going to say, that sounds interesting, but I'm not entirely sure what that means. Just so it doesn't go over my head completely. Can you explain what you mean a little bit more there?
Or just give your example. I'm sure that'll make it clear.
Yeah, okay, sure. So not too long ago, I read a short story by James Joyce, and I'd never read anything by him before, and I was intimidated. And the short story is called Araby. And it starts off with this kid moving to a new house, and in the backyard, there's kind of a small garden, and there's just really grass and one apple tree. And so right there, we have an allusion. And that means that coming from a Judeo-Christian, like, historically country, we generally know what gardens and apple trees mean. It's referring to the Garden of Eden. And so in that first paragraph, I can have some kind of understanding of maybe where the direction this story is going, with a young boy who's about 13 standing in a Garden of Eden. And historically, through a Judeo-Christian tradition, I'm aware of knowing that this represents a fall of innocence. You know, you eat an apple, you get knowledge, and you fall. So right there in that first paragraph, I'm kind of primed for maybe where this story is going. My expectations have been raised to know that this preteen is about to embark on some kind of quest or journey that might result in something that'll meet this expectation of him falling from innocence.
So that's an interesting example, because I suspect I would miss it. Like, I'm aware of the apple imagery, but unless it was very heavily leaned on, I think that I wouldn't notice that if I was just reading a story, because that's not how I generally think.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I mean, but similar techniques, those could definitely be used. Like, I mean, certainly if you got across the idea that there's a Garden of Eden thing going at the beginning of the story, I feel like there, and you know, again, cultural references are hard because some people are very familiar with them, some people are not. But there are certainly ones that have more widespread popularity. So you could certainly use a popular one to sort of set up that expectation that there's going to be a fall from grace. I know for me personally, when I think of an apple tree, I think of all of these like American tall tales.
Yeah.
Something definitely. About George Washington cutting down. For me, like the young man in the apple tree is like, oh no, he's going to cut down that apple tree and get in trouble.
Right. That was when I think it was Paul Bunyan cut down the apple tree with his blue ox who couldn't lie, I think is how that story goes. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, all right, good. But that's a very interesting example.
Yeah, I guess the other point that maybe I could extend this a little bit farther is the point of like an illusion is that writers don't write in a vacuum, right? Everybody mm-hmm. reads everything. And so, you know, one person in their speculative fiction story could be, you know, subtly referencing something that they read in somebody else's, and maybe that plays into the plot. And so, you know, it just really encourages the fact that there's one story being told, and that's the one that we're all writing, trying to figure out what's going on in this crazy place. And so we're constantly like referencing other things, and that might help give people an indication early on where the story is going. And that's generally what I mean by allusions.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Certainly as a writer, paying attention to sort of the meta context, the cultural context surrounding your piece is very important and definitely influences how people interpret it. And that's one of the hard things people have to learn when they're focusing, for instance, on social justice stuff, is that, you know, when you have something like in, you know, the 100, when a lesbian character is shot by a stray bullet and dies right after consummating a relationship, like, that is made more awful because there was Buffy, that happened in Buffy, right? And so...
Uh-huh.
And so that, you know, that context is there whether the writer wanted it to be or not. And a work that I like to think of having actually pretty strong foreshadowing, but you don't usually think about it much because it's a lot of tension foreshadowing, is Lord of the Rings, actually, has quite a bit of foreshadowing in it. And again, Lord of the Rings is a book that has a very slow start. I feel like it's somewhat intentional. I mean, I'm not going to say that it's a strong point of the book, but there is definitely a certain level of, hey, let's introduce you to what's ordinary in this world and have some everyday life so that when we introduce the incredible, it feels incredible. But it is slow, but there is a bunch of foreshadowing there that is meant to sort of establish that things are happening and harm is coming in Frodo's direction. You know, they have little clips. Tolkien puts little clips of the sort of strange men, these strange, you know, it ends up being the Nazgul, sort of asking around after Frodo before he takes off. Same with Gollum. Before Gollum, there's quite a bit. Tolkien doesn't generally introduce antagonists out of the blue. Gollum, you know, they start hearing him pitter-pattering in the background long before you actually see Gollum or are introduced to Gollum. He's been following them for quite some time.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Nazgul like asking around for Frodo, is because the way they're portrayed in the movie, it's just kind of hard to imagine. It's like this giant like hulking figure with a black cloak and a hood that just hides a face of shadows. Like, have you seen this hobbit?
Well, they have a scene hobbit. Of that happening in the movie.
Do they?
They do. Yeah, but it is very fearful. But it is like that. It's very fearful. There's the Nazgul like right up, and there's this hobbit that's just like happens to be working outside in front of his home. And the Nazgul is just like, you know, Frodo, no, Baggins, Shire. And then he just sort of like mumbles back at it and points and then like flees back in his house. Yes,
this is that place. Good job, Mr.
So they actually, but no, you're right. That is kind of a comical scene, but they actually do that in the movie. But in the book, it is certainly more extended and you kind of hear about these things secondhand. So you don't have like a scene. Because he keeps them very mysterious and in the background, right?
And so, like, here's it's something as blatant as when like Gandalf says like look to the east in 3 days, is that, does that count as foreshadowing? Because that's very, you know, that's like Gandalf is straight up saying in 3 days in the east something is going to happen, you should look over there. And so that's like clearly a setup for when he rides over the hill with his like army of horses, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would call that believability foreshadowing, because Gandalf is basically just going to ride in and save the day. And so the more you can foreshadow the happening, the better. I don't think that necessarily makes it good, though. I mean, in The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, Gandalf just rides in last minute and saves the day way too much.
I guess if he's being upfront about it, at least you don't quite feel as betrayed as if he just did it without telling everybody he was going to.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that it helps set expectations and it helps change the stakes of the conflict so that our goal is not to defeat the enemy. Our goal is to survive the enemy for 3 days, for instance.
It's one of those timed levels where you have to do a holdout mission for a certain amount of time.
Yeah. And again, I think a better solution would be to have Gandalf. I feel like that's something you could get away with once in a really long work like Lord of the Rings. But it happens far more often than that. So I don't think it's ideal, but I do think it definitely makes it better to have that sort of set that expectation than it would be if we just didn't do it.
All right. Well, one of the books that I've been reading that has quite strong foreshadowing is a book called Three Parts Dead. And there's some spoilers here because the foreshadowing is for what happens at the end. So if you want to read it without the spoilers, I would recommend it. But basically, there's this, the ending, the big twist at the end is that this god that we thought was dead is actually still alive, right? And they make that, like, the author does a really good job of hinting at that in what I would consider to be very subtle ways. He uses both tension foreshadowing and believability foreshadowing. So like they talk early in what seems like it's just like it's idle speculation regarding something else about how, well, this god's body is technically still intact, but like his soul is completely gone and destroyed, so his body doesn't do him any good. Oh well. And that's foreshadowing for like when it's revealed that his soul is actually hidden somewhere, he has a body to go back to, right? And because you need to set up that rule early, because otherwise it's like, wait, what? You said he was dead. How did he come back? That doesn't make sense.
So he has a horcrux, basically.
Yeah, essentially. Or a phylactery, or whatever you want to call it, right? And they build up that and, like, sort of get you invested in it, because his phylactery is, it turns out, to be the cigarette of this priest, because it's a fire god, right? So he's, like, hiding in the embers of this cigarette that this priest character, it's actually really an acolyte, he's not a full priest, this acolyte character, who is sort of portrayed as like the one, like the guy with actual faith in like a church that's mostly been converted into like a bureaucracy machine.
And that's why he's not a full priest.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying, like, you trusted your soul to an acolyte instead of an actual priest in your church? Okay.
Look, they're all concerned with like collecting donations and building like, you know, cool stained glass windows. Like, this guy actually worships.
Okay.
You know.
That's a neat characterization. I dig it.
And like, there's some foreshadowing that like at the time you can accept it as just stuff that happened. Like, there's this point where when the acolyte runs into a shadow monster and he like out of desperation tries to burn it with his cigarette, and the shadow monster like recoils and he's able to get away. When that first happens, you're kind of like, oh, okay, it's a shadow monster. I guess it's just weak to anything fire or light related, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as the story goes on, it's shown to be stronger than that in other situations, and so you kind of start to wonder, like, what's up with that, right? And so that's just that's a nice bit of foreshadowing. And you also, like, he doesn't, it's subtle, but you notice that he never like lights a new cigarette. He never like uses a lighter to light a cigarette. He always lights a new cigarette off the ember of the old one.
I was gonna ask. Yeah, that makes more sense.
And that's described a number of times, but it's always very subtle. It was never, as I was reading, I was never wondering, why is he doing that? It was like,
did you ever wonder how he sleeps?
Oh,
that's a really good point. I don't know.
Yeah, but maybe he has something that it's like, you know, some sort of fuel that he can just put the ember in and let it do that thing while he sleeps. But still, like, that sounds very nerve-wracking.
Look, Well, because the acolyte doesn't know.
Wait, the acolyte doesn't know that the soul of his god is living in a cigarette?
Yeah, how does he know to not just use matches or something else?
So that's not intentional, then.
No, that was not on purpose. I'm not actually sure what happens when he sleeps, because that is a plot hole now that you mention that. Maybe that was in the book and I just didn't think to notice it.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, like, if he was doing this intentionally, like, I'm sure he could find a solution for keeping the ember hot and living or whatever while he was sleeping, but knowing that this is not on purpose, it's just really hard to believe that he would, like, this ember, like, reincarnation would continue uninterrupted.
Maybe just the nicotine high was so intense that he never needed to sleep, and he figured he would just keep riding it the whole book.
There is a little bit of that. So part of his character is established that he is, like, a super chain smoker, because one of the, before the god died, like, one of the protections that he got was that he suffered no ill effects from smoking.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So he just was constantly smoking, and that's part of his anxiety, is that, like, now that the god's dead, he's like, am I going to get lung cancer? This could be bad. And I guess the explanation for why he never uses a lighter or something is supposed to be subtle influence by, like, his god's presence. But you're right, that part is there's a little bit of wallpapering you have to do over that.
Well, as long as he, you know, I'm sure he doesn't go swimming. But yeah, no, but that's still a very interesting situation. It definitely sounds intriguing.
Certainly when it was revealed to me, I was like, oh, that's cool. I wasn't like, wait, really? That happened? Part of that was because by the end of the book, they had, like, built up this god as being someone I wanted to be alive, because this was, like, a god who was portrayed in contrast to the other gods, who were all, like, super capricious and, like, Roman god style, where they would use people as pawns, whereas this was, like, portrayed as, like, the one god who actually tried to help his people, and, like, mm-hmm. he was, like, killed for it. And so I was really rooting for him by the end, even though he was dead. And so then he comes back, I'm like, yeah, that sounds good. Obviously, I wasn't questioning what happens to the cigarette when the acolyte is sleeping, you know? But I thought that was a mix of believability, foreshadowing, and tension raising.
And I think most books need both to some extent. The question is just how much. I mean, technically, if you've got a lot of, like, immediate action, you don't always need the tension foreshadowing. But tension foreshadowing certainly helps, especially when you have your character resolve a situation. Usually you want some tension foreshadowing in there to keep up the excitement, and so things just don't feel like they're down in a lull.
Yeah, Fahrenheit 451, I actually just finished reading. I know it's an old book, but I only just got around to it. It has really good tension foreshadowing and no believability foreshadowing, and it really suffers from the lack of the second one. Because there's a lot of foreshadowing about, like, what's going to happen to the main character if it's ever discovered that he is hiding books, and, like, there's this mechanical dog that is, like, instrumental in chasing him down, and you can tell straight away that that's gonna happen, right? And there's, like, foreshadowing as to how dangerous this thing is, but and it's, like, you know, and it's, and so he has this whole thing of, like, if I turn against the fire department, that they will sick this mechanical dog on me. But then there are two very important characters. One of them is a group of characters, I guess, but that are instrumental in helping him, that just appear out of the blue. And one of them, like, halfway through the book, he's like, oh, by the way, I also know this guy who is, like, an old academic, and he can help me with this book problem I'm having. And it's like, why is that guy not foreshadowed at all? Like, why are we only just hearing about him?
Yeah, especially if it's super illegal, right?
Yeah, it's really weird that he's suddenly like, oh, also I knew this guy. It's like, that seems, that's awfully convenient.
I guess, like, I mean, I remember reading that and not quite feeling as, I guess, betrayed by that information, because the relationship with the girl in the beginning, like, primed him to start asking questions and remembering previous cases where he was burning books. And that's how he remembers the old man that they first visited. And that's how he knows to go to him. So, I mean, the expectation was set up that he's, like, slowly being, like, having, like, this other world, like, revealed to him, you know?
Right. I could see that being the intent, but the way that it's portrayed is that he's like, oh, right, there was this old guy that I confronted in a park, and we had a talk about books and poetry. Right. I should go talk to that guy. And it's like, it took you this long to remember that? That seems like a thing that you would remember pretty strongly, right? Considering your entire job is to burn books and poetry. Go ahead, Chris.
Right, and I take it that the scene that he refers to with the talk of books in the park and poetry, that's not in the coded in the story, right?
I mean, they flash back to it right there.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's like a covert meeting place where they can go kind of have a, they have like, remember having a chat. I guess I was more betrayed by the fact that at the end, spoilers, right? Like the whole, like he like escapes, crosses the river and just follows train tracks. And then, you know, I can suspend disbelief to see that he would like run into a group of like exiles, you know, who are hoarding books and knowledge and stuff. But then just the city gets like shelled by an air raid that like they mentioned like once. Like, I mean, like the whole war happens. And I just felt like that really hit too hard and out of nowhere.
Prepare for disagreement.
Oh, do it.
I actually think it's the other way around. I think that the war is foreshadowed really well to the point where it's I was just waiting for it to happen because they keep talking about a war, that they're going to war and that bad things are going to happen because like he keeps hearing reports on the radio, which is just the propaganda war, right? Or I should say the propaganda about the war, about how like we're going to go win a war. It's going to be great fun. Right? Like, and he keeps hearing about that, and as the book goes on, he starts thinking, you know, it's probably not going to be great fun. That will probably not be how a war is. So that part made sense. I hated how he just suddenly ran into these guys who not only are preserving books that we've never heard of, but have this elaborate network set up to memorize and preserve books. And it's like, well, I'm glad you guys were on the case. What's weird is that, like, there's a perfect opportunity in that book to introduce these characters, because the Manic Pixie Dream Girl that he runs into at the beginning mentions that she has an uncle who has inspired her to be the way that she is and, like, reject what society and the man are telling her. And I'm like, okay, we're going to meet this uncle, right? He's going to be like a guy who gets Montag. Yeah. Who gets Montag into the resistance or whatever. We never meet the uncle. And like, why isn't one of these guys who showed up out of nowhere the uncle? Because they talked about him a lot.
Actually, this might be as good a point as any to kind of segue into this. Like we talk about how it's like getting set up and believability and stuff, but I wonder like to what extent point of view really plays into that. Like, I mean, because if you are like, in your normal day, maybe you turn down the wrong street and you stumble into a gambling den that's never been foreshadowed in your real life. And, you know, without like omniscient like exposition to maybe lay some groundwork. I don't know. I'm curious what your guys' thoughts are on how like foreshadowing works with like points of view.
Well, certainly no one has ever foreshadowed my real life particularly well. the author is slacking off on that.
Do you mean that the way that the foreshadowing is conveyed?
Well, sure. You know, like go back to really loose point of view structures of like, you know, sitting by the fire, Dickens just relating you like some kind of crazy tale. Like he can drop hints willy nilly all over the place and be completely inconsistent in order to do that.
Right. You mean like the omniscient narrator is like,
yeah,
well, the character didn't know it yet,
yeah,
but soon he would find himself regretting what he just did. Or,
you know. I guess like I think about subtle effective foreshadowing, like relies on the main character, if it's strictly first person, being very aware of like what's going on. Mm-hmm. Maybe I don't know. That's why I raised the question.
You know, okay. So I want to talk about subtle foreshadowing because I think that subtle foreshadowing is important for believability foreshadowing, but it's not important for tension foreshadowing. First, I just want to say that. So, because tension foreshadowing, it's supposed to be obvious. It's there to actually alert us that danger is coming. So we kind of have to know that that's what it's doing. And I mean, I guess that there is a point at which it becomes so obvious that it just feels contrived. Like it doesn't feel like it's a natural part of the story anymore. But generally, I don't think that's a big issue in most of the tension foreshadowing I've seen. And, you know, especially if you like see this robot dog in Fahrenheit 451 and like it tells you how vicious the robot dog is. I don't feel like that necessarily feels like a contrivance. For the believability stuff, I think that when it gets kind of too obvious is when, you know, when especially when you're foreshadowing a reveal, it is supposed to be kind of subtle and it tends to wander into exposition, but it becomes really apparent when there's just no other reason for it to be there. It's like, why are we talking about this? Like, why are we spending, like, for instance, with the guy's cigarette, like, why are we spending so much time talking about how the cigarette, I'm sure that, I have not read Three Parts Dead, I'm sure it doesn't actually do this, because it sounds like it carried it off really well, but if you had characters start making a really big deal about this ember and this cigarette,
yeah.
And you didn't know why. My favorite example, actually, is from the beginning of Sword of Shannara, where there's this character, like, his name is Alanon, but I like to call him Evil Gandalf, and and he's, you know, walking around with this Flick, and you don't know it yet, but Flick is not the main character, but for some reason he's a point of view character for chapter one, and they're just out in the woods together and they're heading home, and Flick has not talked about his family at all, and Evil Gandalf just stops and, like, looks into the distance and just says, "You have a brother."
Oh, do I now?
And it's just, you know, it's like there's no reason for that to be there, and it's making a big deal out of it. So I mean, when I think about subtlety, that's usually what I think about. As far as point of view, I guess omniscient definitely does give you the ability to the flexibility to insert pieces of information in there that's interesting. I still think you would probably have the issue where, you know, a good omniscient narrator only talks about things if they're adding something to the story, right?
Right, yeah.
And so you would still have that problem of, like, why is the narrator talking about this? Whereas, and you never know, maybe with a close point of view that was more restricted, like, it might feel a little bit better because the character can only think about a narrow range of things anyway, what they would naturally think about. So as long as you fit your foreshadowing within what the character would normally be thinking about, it might just feel more natural. On the other hand, though, I imagine a lot of writers would, you know, in trying to fit their foreshadowing in, sort of bend that a little bit and make the character think about something they probably shouldn't be thinking about, in which case it would probably feel very clumsy.
And I mean, like, I think what Wes is talking about, that is a challenge, because in order for your story to be satisfying, you do sometimes have to communicate information to the audience that, in a strictly logical premise, the main character doesn't have a reason to know or think about. That can happen with a limited point of view. In general, I would say there are a couple of ways to handle that. The best way is, if you're going to surprise the audience with something, you do it early, right? Like, you know, for example, if your main character is going to find a gambling den that they had no idea existed, and there's, like, not really any believable way to foreshadow it, that better be something that happens pretty early in the story, because earlier in the story, the audience's expectations have not solidified yet. They're still, like, open to learning new things. It's the same reason why you don't wait until the last chapter to reveal that the main character can shoot lasers out of their eyes and could do it the entire time, but just hasn't had a reason to yet. Like, theoretically, you could construct a story where that happens, right? Where, like, the main character has no reason to shoot lasers out of his eyes for the entire story. He never thinks about it, because why would he? It's just a thing he can do. And then at the end, the bad guys attack him and he shoots lasers out of his eyes. That would be super jarring, right?
That's like most Superman comics, right? Where he just seems to, like, constantly forget about stuff that he's capable of doing. I have freeze breath? What?
Superman has freeze breath?
Depending on the continuity, yes. He also has an amnesia kiss in certain continuities.
What?
Yeah, if you name it, there's probably a Superman story somewhere where he has it as a power.
Amnesia kiss.
Yeah, amnesia kiss.
Does
literally
he,
a thing.
Does he use this kiss on men occasionally?
Oh, you wish. So anyway, the point is that, like, if you have a situation where you need to foreshadow something, but it doesn't work for the main character to know it either, or the main character knowing it would, like, spoil the story or whatever, you can set up a situation where, like, something similar might happen, but different. Like, so for example, if they had set up in Fahrenheit that there were, like, these weirdos outside of the city, and that they were considered to be kind of dangerous because, you know, they're like degenerates who live outside civilization, right? And they had established that more firmly as like a thing, and there was the reason that in character that we think that it's important to know that is because it's like, well, that's why it's dangerous, that's why you never go outside the city, right? That's why you stay here and drive your cars too fast and have your giant TVs for walls, which sound awesome, by the way. Give me some of that.
No, Orin, it's rampant, like, you know, consumerism. You can't.
Yeah, I want to consume. So like, and then you have, he finally goes outside the city because he has no other choice, and he meets them, and it's like, oh, actually, they do this other thing. And it's like, okay, see, that's a surprise. The main character doesn't, like, the surprise is preserved, but it's still not coming completely out of nowhere, right?
I think you make a really good point. I concede, because thinking back on that book, there's plenty of opportunities where that conversation could have happened naturally, like when his chief is kind of grilling him a little bit because he's wondering if Montag's, like, you know, starting to hoard books or if he's not following the rules. You know, he could have easily dropped that information that would have set it up more naturally. So, yeah, fair point.
Yeah, it was doable. And I mean, and to be completely fair to Ray Bradbury, he like wrote this book in like days,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it shows. It's the sort of thing where if he'd had more time to edit it, he probably would have made the connection. Oh, yeah, I spent time setting up this uncle. I could just use that guy instead of inventing a new character halfway through the book. But when you turn in your first draft that you wrote in 9 days because you're paying, like, by the hour to use a typewriter and your family has to eat, sometimes you don't think about that sort of thing.
Speaking of fitting foreshadowing to a character's viewpoint, so Harry Potter, actually, I think it's a good example of a lot of believability foreshadowing, particularly because Rowling uses an arbitrary magic system. And again, so many Harry Potter fans are just getting mad at me for saying that the magic system isn't rational. And but it's not. I'm not calling it irrational. Not trying to set up a rational versus irrational binary. I call magic systems that are not rational arbitrary. And Rowling actually, you know, it's harder to work with them, but it's not like they can't work. Rowling does set it up so that, you know, before any spell is used in a pivotal moment for believability, she introduces it first, which is the important thing. And the nice thing about rational systems is that you don't have to do that. But she has an arbitrary system and she does do it pretty effectively. And, you know, the premise of Harry Potter going to school for magic makes that much easier because she can narrate his classes, you know, and then include, hey, now that he's struggling this with a spell, he now has learned how to use the spell, oh, now he's fighting a villain and he can use the spell against the villain. So it works out quite well. And of course she likes her world to be very playful and kind of spontaneous, so it fits that really well. So there's quite a bit of, you know, very careful setup of all of the magic that's done throughout Harry Potter so that her sort of climactic scenes sort of feel believable. And, you know, one book I'm thinking about recently is like The Firestone, which is by Tanya Huff, where not only does the magic system like feel like it's arbitrary, but you have no idea what the character can and cannot do.
Yep.
You have no idea, like, you know, her spells just, they come at the moment and you have no idea. Whereas in Harry Potter, you, even though the system is arbitrary, you always have a certain, I mean, don't get me wrong, with an arbitrary system that is over 7 books, there's always going to be powerful spells that could be useful in a situation that are forgotten. That's the big weakness, right? It's like, why don't they use that super powerful spell again? It would be super useful here. At the same time, I don't ever get the sense that, like, we don't know what Harry Potter is capable of. You know, he has a sort of go-to set of spells that were sort of useful, whereas in a lot of other arbitrary magic systems where it's not handled as well, it's like you have no idea what this mage could pull out of their sleeve. And if they're a protagonist, that's kind of a problem.
Speaking of pulling things out of our sleeve, we are actually over our time now. I only got to the first example on my list, but thank you, Wes, for joining us for this topic of discussing foreshadowing.
Happy to do it.
And there's a decent chance you will hear Wes again on the podcast. Woo! Tension foreshadowing.
Yeah, tension.
All right. Well, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can email us at podcast@mythgreens.com. And otherwise, we will talk to you next week. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess.
Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess who saved herself.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself by Jonathan Coulton.